We emerged as part of a beautiful ancient song. Somewhere along the way between grain taxes and alphabets, we began playing our own song, increasingly out of tune with the orchestra. This is Muse Ecology, where we hear some of the voices and grooves of people and place as we make our way back to harmony.
We have an economic system that essentially is focused on growth, and by growth we are constantly looking to reevaluate new sources of economic growth. And what that means is putting all types of forces and all types of energy towards one sector in order to grow that as a means to actually develop the society, create jobs, and everything else like that. And what we see now is that's focused on the clean energy transition or anything that's called decarbonization, clean energy. So there's such a huge focus on doing that that we forget to actually assess what are the long-term implications. And that perhaps is the bigger, the more accurate crisis that I would say is the source and the core of it is evaluating actions today from the framework of long-term implications. And we don't do that enough.
Everything has life, everything has spirit, and everything has power. We do not, as Shoshone people, make humans more important than the bird flying in the air, the fish swimming in the water, or the deer walking on the land. We are as one, and we all have the respect and the responsibility and reciprocity and the relationship to live in this world.
When you said that it was going to be this discussion of all these really diverse perspectives, I was somehow fearing that we were going to be going at it hammer and tongs, but so far I've agreed with everything both of you have said. So in many ways, Bright Green Lies is simply a plea for us to look at the implications. You know, probably if Saad had written the book, he could have done a better job because it took us 560 pages, what it took him one sentence to say of let's look at the implications.
In the previous episode, we visited the sagebrush ecology of Thacker Pass, Nevada, the site of a proposed lithium pit mine, where we heard diverse voices in opposition to the project and the effects it would have on water, air, life, and the health and culture of the local Paiute community. Since releasing that episode, two indigenous groups from the region have joined the array of plaintiffs in the legal efforts to stop the lithium mine, and at the camp, they've begun doing direct action training, preparing to continue the resistance if the legal action fails. All around the world, projects like the proposed Thacker Pass lithium mine are being fast-tracked to supply the minerals required by the explosive growth of the renewable energy and electric car industries. In this volt rush, little consideration is given to the destructive effects of its supply chain on water, air, life, and local communities, most often indigenous. And when we consider the second leg of climate change we learned about from Professor Mian Mian at the beginning of this Water, Life, Climate, and Civilization series, how when we disrupt the surface properties of the living earth, we directly affect hydrology, weather, and climate, sacrificing ecology and hydrology for lithium and other minerals in order to address anthropogenic climate change makes even less sense. While support for indigenous sovereignty and respect for water and life are becoming increasingly normalized as cultural values, when mining projects threaten these things, the only resistance is still grassroots legal battles and direct action conflicts as we see in Thacker Pass. Given the shared values at stake, it seems that increased collaboration toward more accountability of the renewables industry is possible, but only if we are able to have conversations that connect information between current silos of thinking. Renewables professionals, activists, ecologists, atmospheric scientists, policymakers, they all have insights to share and things to learn. Diverse civil discourse can lead to more complex and relevant questions and eventually novel solutions. The panel discussion in this episode felt like a great step in that direction, and I'm grateful for each of the panelists' contributions as we explored this challenging topic together. Saad Youssefi brought his economic insights and his experience consulting governments and international corporations on energy production projects. He's also co-authored a book on energy storage for practitioners. Mary Gibson brought her Western Shoshone cultural relationship with the land and life that have long been devastated and are still threatened by the mining industry and colonialism in general. She's also on the board of the Great Basin Resource Watch, one of the environmental protection nonprofits litigating the Thacker Pass project. And Derek Jensen brought his decades as a dedicated activist and advocate for the living earth. He's authored dozens of books on the subject, most recently co-authoring a book called Bright Green Lies, How the Environmental Movement Lost Its Way and What We Can Do About It, about the devastating effects of the renewables industry on the biosphere. Of course, we didn't solve the problems in this conversation, but everyone listened to each other and was heard, and we found plenty of common ground to discuss. I look forward to more such conversations in the future, including discussions of how we might incorporate the second leg in our approach to anthropogenic climate change. Well, Mary and Saad and Derek, welcome. I'm much looking forward to this conversation, and thank you all for being here. Yeah, I feel that, you know, civil discourses such as this between kind of divergent perspectives or what we see as silos of thinking seems to me to be a real essential part of information flow and the adaptability of social systems as a whole. So really looking forward to that and just to having different perspectives together, see what we can all learn. So thank you. I want to get into some specifics on renewables and things especially maybe some solar, because I know Derek, you'd like to talk about that, and Saad, that's an expertise, and lithium's pretty hot, and also where some developing innovations might be going, and how those play off of all of our perspectives, and then possibly a conversation on, you know, what can accountability look like? You know, what can we all kind of agree on that, because right now the limiting factors that guide our innovation, when it comes to ecology and local communities, is things like we see at Thacker Pass. You have, you know, the limiting factors for that company to do that is, you know, the cost of legal battles with grassroots environmental organizations. And, if it starts, then lost work days, because you have angry youth and prayerful elders putting their bodies between the land and the machines. And it seems like we all care about a lot of the same things. So how can we possibly move forward in a way that, those aren't our only kind of agreed upon limiting factors that guide our innovation? So that's another possible avenue. But before getting into any specifics, I'd love to just go a little more general and maybe do a round of a couple of questions for you each to answer so we can kind of get a feel for each other and get started that way. All right. So, for the first question, if you could all each just share who you are, what you do, and whatever you'd like to share about your intentions and or like hopes for this conversation, just to get started. Mary, would you like to start?
Sure. Nananeha Mary Gibson, na Dimokanua, Elko, Nevada, and I, Nabi, Barbara Jackson, Ridley, Nagaku, Alice, Dick Jackson, Biowawi, Cortez, and I, Nadogo, James, Jimmy Jackson, Mona Trevally, and I, Mamahaganat. Hello, my name is Mary Gibson. I am a Timok tribal member of the Western Shoshone Elko Band. My mother is Barbara Jackson Ridley, who had come from Cortez, Biwawi, Nevada area. My maternal grandmother is Alice Dick Jackson, also coming from Cortez and Biwawi, Nevada. And my grandfather is the late Jimmy Jackson, coming from Monitor Valley, one of the bigger Shoshone valleys in Nevada. I'm glad that you have asked me to be here. Thank you. And it's great to meet the others. Thank you.
All right. I guess I'll go in order of my screen. Saad, would you like to go next? Introduce.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Thank you. Thank you, Tim, Mary, and Derek. Great to be here. So my background, as Tim alluded to briefly, is in renewable energy, and more specifically in the generation part of renewables. And I have a background in spending a lot of time with solar energy. So being someone that kind of looks at the technical merits, the technical advancements, as well as what that means from an economic perspective. And that is something that I kind of use in order to do advisory work and help companies build projects in the U.S. and internationally. And over time, I've had a chance to work both in the U.S. as well as a lot of projects internationally. And that gave me a global perspective of what are the challenges that we face in the U.S. versus ones that we face, that other places face. And also, what is the trend that we see going forward? I also come with a finance background, where I can also, beyond the engineering, also discuss what the implications are, because what I've seen overall is looking at incentives and looking at financial incentives and what are the interests of the different parties and how can we kind of ally those or change those interests, and whenever there's a conflict, really changes the game and the parameters. So I really want to, as part of this conversation, provide some level of optimism in that there is a way that we can change our perspectives, and that there are challenges going forward, but we have means and ways for us to solve those. And that's one of my goals in sharing that, and sharing at least the energy generation part of my background. So glad to be here and looking forward to this conversation.
Great. Thank you. And yeah, just add that it is Bastille Day. So happy Bastille Day. So speaking of, conflicts change the nature of things, and they can always escalate. So as opposed to just, only, like I said, only being left with the action of increasing mobs, what can we do to make some sense together without having to go there? Derek.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's nice to meet all of you. And I'm a longtime grassroots environmental activist and the author of, 26 or 27 books. And also, if we end up talking about technical stuff at all, I just want to mention that my first degree was in physics, and I've forgotten almost everything I ever learned. And then the last thing I want to mention in the intro is that I lived for 2 years in Carlin. So I know that region a little bit. My main memory of that time is, it's the only place I've ever lived where, and this is not an exaggeration, you can literally, on some days, you can literally see the mercury in the thermometer, move down after sunset, where you could have a nice sunny day and then it might get down to 10 degrees at night, certain times of year. So biggest single day change in temperature in any place I've ever lived. Oh, and now the other thing I guess to mention is that I live in the redwood rainforest on the coast of California. A little bit different than Nevada.
A little different, yeah. But like I discussed with this one ecologist and some others when I was there, it's interesting because the old growth sage sagebrush and, you know, that habitat, it looks different than an old redwood forest, but it still has this mature functionality to it when you really get into it. And it's just not as obvious, you know, but it has its own beauties as well. All right. So for my second kind of just general, get to know each other and feel into the topics, question. First of all, could we all agree that we are in some form of global crisis right now? Does anybody not agree with that?
What was the question? I missed that. I'm sorry.
Do we all agree that we are in some form of global crisis right now?
I think we are.
I may be a tiny bit picky, I would say we are in multiple global crises, plural, but that's it.
Great. Yeah, not all the same thing. Okay. So my question, if we could do another round, and I guess maybe we'll go backwards now. We'll start with you, Derek. So how would you describe your understanding of the nature of the crisis, and if possible, maybe speak to its roots? And then also, what sort of considerations do you find it necessary that we take into consideration to address that crisis? Would you like to start, Derek?
Sure. Thank you for the question. I think the primary crisis that we're facing is that this culture is killing the planet. And, you know, it doesn't really matter which metric we use. All biological indicators are going the wrong direction. And and somebody could quibble, you know, we're not killing the planet, but the way I usually respond to that is, you know, if somebody were being, when somebody at a talk that I give says, we're not killing the planet, I ask somebody in the audience if they can give me a knife. And then I take the knife and I go to the person, I ask them if they can give me their hand. And of course they never do. And I wouldn't do it anyway, but I say, don't worry, I'm not going to kill you. I'm just going to cut off your fingers and then I'm going to start to flay your skin. And then I'm going to, and eventually your heart will stop, but there will still be biological activity. I mean, there will be plenty of bacteria inside of you. So the point is, if somebody says that that's hyperbolic, I just point out that there's 200 species going extinct today, et cetera, et cetera. And so the crisis we face is that we are undercutting the basis for life on, so far as we know, the only planet in the universe that has life. And the roots of that go way back. When we think about Iraq, is the first thing that we think about cedar forests so thick that sunlight never touches the ground. It was heavily forested until the first written myth of Western civilization is Gilgamesh deforesting the hills and valleys of Iraq. And Arabia was oak savanna, and the Near East was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. I don't remember if it's Plato. I think it was Plato, but it might have been Aristotle, was complaining that deforestation was harming water quality. And I'm pretty sure that they said to him, we need to study this for a few years to make sure there's actually a correlation. North Africa was heavily forested. Those went down to make the Egyptian and Phoenician navies. And so the problem fundamentally, I mean, we can talk about the idea that humans are the only species who matter. We can talk about the great chain of being, which perceives, you know, that there's a hierarchy of nature with God at the top and then humans and then non-humans and then plants and then, and each one is more matter and less mind. And we can talk about the problems with that, but I think and I'll say one more thing and I'll quit. The fundamental problem is that we are living in a way, we have devised a way of living that brings us material advantage at the expense of the land base, and that is not sustainable. And then the last thing I'll say is that we all of my work really is about that this way of living won't last, and when it's over, I would prefer that there's more of the world left rather than less. So it's like a summation of 27 books in one sentence. So that's the short version of the problem for me.
Great, yeah. And, yeah, as far as the root goes, you know, when I often talk about it, it's very, very close in timing to, you know, but it's the Enuma Elish that I usually refer to, which is a little bit after that, the Gilgamesh, the Babylonian creation myth. And in Gilgamesh, when, Gilgamesh and, I forget his wild friend, when they, kill the guardian of the forest and cut down the trees, the gods were like mad. The gods didn't appreciate it. But they kind of let it go, and it just, so there was still this, kind of, play between city life and the wild life and a question of what that is. But then in the Babylonian creation myth, we see, as I did a retelling of it in the prelude to this series, the Water, Life, Climate and Civilization series, we have this, the younger gods actually killing the sweet water god that flows into Tiamat, the wild mother. And then she finally, then that gets her mad, and then they get scared, and then strong Marduk, this young god, he slays Tiamat, the primordial wild mother, and then creates a new world out of her body. So that's kind of like the where this kind of, I would say, this sort of inherently expanding parasitic pattern, we can at least trace it back to that, where all the sort of elements are in play in that myth, you know, that we're kind of still living out. So yeah, I guess that's me answering the question too about roots. But so we'll move on to Saad. Would you like to share your thoughts on the nature of the global crisis and what we might need to take into consideration, and roots, if any thoughts on that?
Yeah. I'd say, you know, there are a lot of crises, as they're correctly and accurately alluded to. The one that I think a lot about, that I think people on the channel should be cognizant about, is we have an economic system that essentially is focused on growth. And by growth, we are constantly looking to reevaluate new sources of, you know, economic growth. And what that means is putting all types of forces and all types of energy towards one sector in order to grow that as a means to actually develop the society, create jobs and everything else like that. And what we see now is that's focused on the clean energy transition, or anything that's called decarbonization, clean energy. So there's such a huge focus on doing that we forget to actually assess what are the long-term implications. And that perhaps is the bigger, the more accurate crisis that I would say is the source and the core of it, is evaluating actions today from the framework of long-term implications. And we don't do that enough. And one of your episodes, Tim, very accurately looked and discussed the feedback loop, and discussing, well, we have a longer feedback loop in order to assess and assess what happened. And we're right now at the very pushing really hard for the energy transition, and doing a lot of projects and a lot of huge transformational shifts within our economic system and our societies and different organizations. But we don't accurately know what are the long-term implications of this, and that is that I think is the core crisis and problem that we have, is have we accurately assessed what is the implication for the energy transition that we're going through right now, and all the changes that we are that we're asking people to go through, and societies and companies and, you know, investors and everything else like that. So that's, I'll focus on that, and that's probably something that I can talk intelligently about during the session.
Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you. That's great. Mary, do you like to describe how you see the nature of the global crisis and possibly its roots, and what you feel we need to keep in consideration to address it?
Sure. With my Western Shoshone perspective, I think because we our worldview is a holistic view. Everything matters. Everything works together in synchronicity. Because of this view that we have, we consider the earth a living person, almost like a relative of ours. In fact, that is what our worldview is. Everything has life, everything has spirit, and everything has power. We do not, as Shoshone people, make humans more important than the bird flying in the air, the fish swimming in the water, or the deer walking on the land. We are as one, and we all have the respect and the responsibility and reciprocity and the relationship to live in this world. So I see our planet in a crisis in which it affects my world, my Shoshone world, and it affects my religion and spirituality with the destruction, mainly from extractive industries. I don't know, I guess being a Native Indigenous person, I see the root of the crisis that we're in is colonization. We've been dispossessed from our lands here in the Americas on Turtle Island. And capitalism plays a big part in the environmental injustices happening to Indigenous people and, of course, many marginalized people. I don't know, as an Indigenous person, with that holistic view in mind, I think we have to just learn how to live within our means, take only what we need and leave the rest, make decisions that involve or at least have thought for future generations. We aren't the only ones here. We have to think of the future, not only human future, but in wildlife, everything that is life. That's how I'll address the crisis and perhaps ways of finding different lifestyles to be able to sustain humanity.
Beautiful. Yeah, I love that, and then the question of how that perspective of the earth as a whole living being, you know, composed of all these living beings, how that perspective can permeate all of our human activities. Like, how is that possible? And I really appreciate that question. Kind of helps to kind of guide all the questions in a way. I'd like to get into a little bit of specifics and see how some of these, how our perspectives kind of play together. And maybe we could start with solar. So I know, Derek, one of the books that you just recently came out this year that you co-wrote, it's called Bright Green Lies, and there's a whole chapter on solar. I think, and I'd also like to get into lithium, but maybe for solar, Derek, you could start and talk about the problems you see with solar, and then maybe Saad, if you'd like to share something, and feel free to have a back and forth, whatever comes up, there's no rules there. And then Mary, anything from your perspective that you see, even with respect to how the conversation, just anything. And I really feel like we have kind of a really beautiful triangle of perspective here, and I'm curious to see how that moves. And then maybe talk about lithium, and maybe Saad, you could start on that. Cause I think it's also kind of a key topic. Derek, can you kind of introduce the topic of solar from your perspective and, anything you'd like to share on that?
Well, sure. And before I say that, I would like to say how much I enjoyed what both Saad and Mary said. And I was when you said that it was going to be this discussion of all these really diverse perspectives, I was somehow fearing that we were going to be going out at hammer and tongs, but so far I've agreed with everything both of you have said. And I think that one of the things Asad said that I really like and really forms the basis of Bright Green Lies, the book, is that we really need to look at the implications of what we are doing, and we need to do to follow back chain of supply and for what we make, and we need to then follow it to its final waste products, and we need to ask the implications of what we do. So with a lot of the sort of mainstream solar boosters, they seem to forget that, as one of my co-authors said, Lear Keith, in the book, but solar panels don't come from the solar panel tree. And, you know, they come from somewhere, and that requires mining, and it requires certain, it requires transportation infrastructure, and requires entire infrastructures. And then once you have the energy, what are you going to do with the energy too? What happens to it? How is it used? And, so we can get into specifics if you want, but I think that Saad already said the fundamental question, which is we need to ask, you know, what are the implications? For example, Jacobson, Eric Jacobson, talks about how you can convert the entire, economy to so-called renewables, but he doesn't, if you do the math on it, it ends up that in order to put in all the windmills that he wants would require, I believe, 1.5 times the entire world's output of, iron, just for that. And, it would require basically the equipment, the concrete and steel that would be the equivalent of 12 Hoover dams a day. And it's fine that he comes up with this plan, but my complaint is not that he comes up with the plan, but my complaint is he comes up with the plan without explicitly acknowledging that this would require massive amounts of iron. And what does that imply? Massive amounts of concrete. What does that imply? So in many ways, Bright Green Lies is simply a plea for us to look at the implications. You know, probably if Saad had written the book, he could have done a better job, because it took us 560 pages, what it took him one sentence to say of, let's look at the implications.
You're certainly giving me more credit than I deserve, Derek. But yeah, I'll let you finish, and then I had like just a comment as to continue as to what you were saying.
And the other thing that I can either just bring it up now and we can talk about it at some point, or we can talk about it later. Another thing that has to be part of any conversation about renewables is something called Jevons paradox. And should I go ahead and just do a 3-sentence or 5-sentence version of that now?
Yeah, let's go ahead and introduce it, and then it can be there on the table for the discussion. Yeah.
Okay. And Jevons paradox, he was a economist who studied coal back in the 19th century. And what he found is that if you find a more efficient way to use coal, it doesn't actually decrease coal use, but it increases coal use. You would think it would decrease it, because if you can find a way to heat a house with half as much coal, or, you know, heat a boiler or anything, that would be, you'd use less coal. But the truth is that, especially when you have a growth economy, that if you find a way to more efficiently use coal, it actually increases demand, because now the company is going to, the corporations are going to expand, the factories are going to expand. And the same thing is true with houses, that housing, I think our housing energy efficiency has gone up by, I don't know, I'm making up the number, but it's like, let's say 50% in the last 40 years. And I could be way off on the number, but it doesn't matter. So what has happened is that house size, especially United States, has increased by about the same amount. So we're actually using about the same amount of energy for heating houses, but it's just now we've got bigger houses with more embodied energy in them. So Jevons' paradox is simply that when you increase the efficiency of something, it generally adds on. So up until, I don't know, 1800 or something, or 1700, somewhere in there, something, a couple hundred years ago, the main energy uses for humans were human and non-human slavery, draft animals and human slaves, and the wood. And then as coal was brought online, it didn't actually decrease the amount of wood used for energy. It just added. And then as oil came online, it didn't decrease the amount of coal, but added on top. As hydro came online, it didn't decrease the previous ones. Every single one, when they basically add on. And so that's, you know, we can say, yay, we have great new solar panels, but it's like, did they actually take out oil or did they just add on? And I think I just wish we were asking these questions publicly. That's my main deal.
You know, there, you bring up a good question or comments, which is around, as a product or a solution becomes more and more economical, then the demand for that just increases significantly. And that's certainly the case of what we see in solar. Like over the last 10 years or so, we literally went from, a factor of 90%, cheaper or lower cost to produce electricity with solar to the point where today it is the cheapest source of energy, period. Like, the cheapest way for you to produce a unit of kilowatt hours is solar energy, especially when you look at large systems. The challenge that I've always seen with that is, you can talk about land use. So it requires a lot of land if you are thinking of large scale systems. That's one of those. But the biggest problem for people in the industry is, well, you can only produce it when the sun is out. So how do you think and how do you resolve the problem of storage? And that's the holy grail part that people in the renewable energy are all talking about. And we don't know what that would look like. And, you know, we are going to talk about lithium being lithium ion and lithium batteries being one of those enabling solutions. But the studies that I've seen pretty much suggest that solar and wind will contribute almost 70% of all new energy generation going forward. So much of it is going to be that. Cost is one element. The fact that it's flexible and it could be installed anyway. And then because it's getting cheaper, even locations that are not known to have a lot of sun, you know, not California, not Nevada, not the west coast of the United States, become very suitable for the solution. So the demand is huge. It's growing. There are supply chain issues right now. Like even with all the gigawatt capacities that are built across the world, it still doesn't meet the demand, and it's growing much faster than expected. And getting all of the resources necessary is a challenge. Such that it's the first year this year where we actually saw the cost of producing panels, solar panels, actually increase slightly as opposed to drop significantly. Every year for the last 15 years or 10 years, they've been dropping in a magnitude of, you know, two digits or so. And then this year it actually increased slightly. You know, we can account for different reasons for that. But that is a new paradigm. I'd say what keeps me positive or what keeps me maybe optimistic is the fact that if we can make every solar panel increase in its efficiency, then you per se wouldn't, and if that efficiency increase is higher than the consumption or needs or growth in demand, then you're essentially using less resources per every solar panel or every solar project that requires. And I think we are going there, but the big question right now is, as we talk about decarbonization and producing electricity to electrify everything, be it transportation, be it our factories, be it anything that we deal with, the demand is just going to be really outpace the supply or any ability for us to meet the supply, including the innovation of making the cells more efficient and and reducing the need for more resources and minerals and metals. So that I share with you very much. This is purely at the solar side, despite having a supply chain that's pretty developed and all. If we talk about batteries, that's even, you know, a much, much bigger problem that we certainly aren't there from an economic perspective and a technical perspective. But yeah, that's some perspective that I wanted to share being in the industry itself that I share with you here as well, Derek and Tim and Mary, if you had any comments or anything that I can add to it.
I'd like to just interject and kind of connect this with the implications of renewable energies and connect it with the principle that one of the principles I live by, and that's responsibility. As humans and I guess the most powerful that we seem to be entitled to, what are our responsibilities to keep our planet healthy? You look at the people and you can judge by looking at the people what condition the land is in. What are we doing to the land with trying to find trying to find solutions to fossil fuels and a transition to clean energy. When we don't think, once again, when we're not thinking about the future and we're only thinking about today, I think we tend to want to, there's the ability to destroy more things that is necessary. I understand that solar energy is going to require everything that seems to be the evil in my homeland, and that's mining of some sort, mining for steel, as one of you mentioned. Of course, mining, everything involves mining if we're going to live in the 21st century. But I just want to emphasize that at some time in our life on this planet, we do have to take responsibility. If that means to, cut down on our energy use or find alternative energies, we need to think about all the other living things around us and their right to life as well as the way we see it. To me, technology just seems to expand and continue, and they call it progress. And I'm wondering, is it really progress as we destroy the earth, as we destroy our waters and the air that we breathe? Our soils are contaminated anywhere there's mining involved. How is that progress? It seems more destruction. And when we're not looking at the implications of what this means for the future, that is very frightening. It almost seems like we're almost at a point where as human people, we don't care enough to change our patterns of life, the way we live our life and the way that convenience means everything to us anymore. But we know that our ancestors didn't always have a convenient life. They worked hard. They had to sustain and have that relationship with Mother Earth. Otherwise, that implication would have been gone many, 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 many centuries ago. So I guess I just wanted to bring up the fact that we are responsible. You know, every individual is responsible for maintaining a healthy planet so that we as humans and everything that walks upon our earth is healthy and have the right to live, have that right to life as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, there's a lot of, in all that. I love it. I think the Jevons paradox thing is really important to think about at, you know, together with what you're just mentioning, Mary, a lot of these impacts that we don't often, put into our analyses. Saad, I had a clarification question and then, another thought on kind of that. The clarification question was when you say solar will account for 70% of energy use. I know Derek, I've heard you make a distinction before between electricity and energy. Saad, are you specifically referring to electricity use or energy use in general when you say that?
Thanks for the prompt. I mean, electricity generation is specifically what I refer to. And when I mean 70%, it's the new generation. So new generation that's put in place annually is going to be primarily, that's installed is going to be primarily renewable based because economically and because of different elements there.
Gotcha. Interesting. And then as we also talk about impacts of renewables, this all plays into itself. Like with the Jevons paradox thing, I know you said there's this, you use the phrase electrify everything. It's one of those things that we hear now. And it's, if I imagine, like, say we were still just using fossil fuels and we didn't have this renewables conversation with, that was imbued with this hope for like a harmonious, renewable energy industry, you know, it's what we have this hope for that. And it's almost like that hope enables to, okay, now that we have that hope, let's electrify everything and it'll work out, right? So it seems like that might be an example of Jevons' paradox, that hope kind of alleviates some of the, mental cost of thinking let's electrify everything. You know, see, it all seems to play in together. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I'd say, what everybody's looking to solve right now, and the key, if I were going to be even more specific in terms of the keywords and the mission that you see companies and investors and just society talk about, is decarbonization. So it's like, we want to decarbonize everything. And what that means is essentially, can we use renewables or clean energy for everything? And, you know, then the demand for doing that is very big. So, from moving from generating our own electricity using renewables and then shifting that and maximizing the use of it with batteries or other forms of technologies, that is a big thing that hasn't been solved yet. And decarbonization is really what people are considering the big thing. But what are the implications of the minerals and the resources that are necessary to electrify everything and decarbonize the economy? That I don't see much discussion around.
Right. And especially also the climate implications, as I know you listened to the Professor Mian episode and how we've known for 50 years that our effects of the surface properties of the earth directly affect weather and climate patterns and stuff. Derek, do you have anything to add to what's been said since you talked last?
I love what everybody's saying. And, I especially wanted to thank Mary for the points about responsibility. And I love the root of the word responsibility. Responsibility comes from a root meaning to give and return. And that's exactly what we need to do. You know, on every level, you know, my mom died a few years ago and I took care of her through her death. And that was my responsibility, by which I don't mean a duty that I do reluctantly, but I was giving in return for everything she'd given me. And it's the same with all this, that, you know, this planet really gave us life, and how can we give in return? That's one thing. The next thing is that when I think about, I think it's really important for us to always ask, and this is stuff that just guides everything I do, is do desert tortoises want solar energy facilities? Do pronghorn antelope want lithium mines? And I think those are questions we really need to ask. And then the next thing I wanted, I guess there's two more things. One of them is that we talk a lot about lithium, and lithium's really important for things like transportation. But something that blew me away, I had no idea this when we started working on Bright Green Lies, but when we wrote the book, as we were writing a draft of it, 99% of grid scale energy storage is what's called pumped hydro, which is just big dams. And you have two dams, and then you pump it up when you've got a lot of energy, and then you let it go back down. And dams are incredibly destructive. So there's It was, I think when the book came out, our final draft, we switched it from like 99% to 97 or 95. It's still the overwhelming majority. And it's really interesting that, and I'm not attacking anybody for this. I just think it's really fascinating that we talk a lot about lithium, but literally 95% of grid scale storage, at least, is just big dams. So I just think it's interesting that we don't really talk about that very much. And then the last thing I want to say is one of the difficulties. Okay. Two more things to say. One of them is that a line we keep saying all through the book is we quote Naomi Klein as saying that she's been to a bazillion climate marches, but polar bears don't do it for her. And I think that that's, we quote that a bunch of times because it's really important that ultimately what at least I'm talking about is values. And what do you really value? And if you value, if you value the growth of the economic system, that will lead you to make a certain set of assumptions and then a certain set of decisions. If you value pronghorn antelope or desert tortoises, that will lead you to, over the growth of the economic system, that will lead to a different set of decisions. And so I think it's really important for us to sort of root around and try to figure out what our values are. And then the last thing I want to say about this that is just a technical difficulty with the decarbonization is that unfortunately diesel is incredibly energy dense. So it will hold, I believe it's 46 megajoules per kilogram. And what the actual units don't matter, but lithium, and Saad can correct me on this if I got the number wrong, but I think lithium is like 1 megajoule per kilogram, or maybe it's 4 or 5, but it's really low. So one of the difficulties, I was talking to Alice Friedman about this a while ago, and she pointed out that you have a semi-truck will have a 60,000 pound payload and it can go 600 miles on, I don't know, 100 pounds of diesel. And in order to have the same payload and the same range, you would have to have 55,000 pounds of batteries. So because it's much lower energy density. So it ends up, there are some things, electricity is one reason, one thing we always talk about because it is easier to decarbonize in some ways not. And then things like transportation are a much, even ignoring the effects of truck transportation on the health of the planet, it's just a much thornier technical, even just engineering problem because of the high energy density of diesel and the relatively low energy density of batteries.
I can comment. So you talked about energy density, and that's something that a lot of the technical breakthroughs that come to batteries is around. And then energy density is especially important if you're thinking of how much space do you have or how much weight do you care about. So inside of a car, very important. For a grid scale level, well, you have the whole open area that's open, so you're not as much you don't care as much about energy density, unless you have very constrained areas and space or weight. So when it comes to stationary, it's not as important. What is different though from a combustion engine that you talk about compared to, you know, a clean or a electric vehicle situation is you're talking about efficiency, round trip efficiencies. And for the amount of combustion, there's a lot of loss that happens with heating, which when you look at how much energy have you produced in order to, you know, to sustain and to go about it, you're only really talking about, you know, definitely less than 50%, more like 30%, is really what you end up using, as a unit and available for that. So, while a lot of discussion is around energy density, it makes sense for a car, you know, where you have space and you have like weight that is important. The technical break every year, you have more and more density. So I think directionally, I'm not too concerned about that. And we are going to see that more and more, not even marginal, like actually big breakthroughs. especially when you talk about solid state batteries. So that's the next level of lithium ion batteries and systems. I was gonna comment on your comments on pumped hydro, which is really, really true. And that's that, so much of the big challenge with renewable energy transition is that renewable energy is intermittent. So what do you need to use, and you need to have a base load, what we call an energy or electricity markets, base load generation, which is what can operate on a 24-hour basis and that is stable, and that you can then complement with renewable energy that is cheaper. So from a world that was focused primarily on one generation load that was constant 24/7 forever, now you're actually dealing with, I have my energy coming from nuclear, from water, from whatever it is, and then I supplement it with renewable during the day when there's a sun, or I supplement it when it's windy with the wind. And then now the next phase of the discussion is, now you overproduce during the day, you can store it and you can transition and transfer it, shift it towards the evenings or towards non-producing times. And the hydro is just such an important part of that transition. If you're thinking of how can we achieve decarbonization, such that we probably, you know, we're facing desertification. We're facing, even in California and in the West, we have areas that hydro dams that are not operating to the extent that they were designed to do because of a lack of hydrology or hydrological resources. So that is going to be a very big challenge, is what are we going to be using as a base load, which is completely independent from the renewable energy discussion? And can we just build more dams? I mean, do we have that many more dams or areas that are not already developed and that are, you know, good resources? I'm not sure. At least in the U.S. So that's one question or one comment that I had around hydro being such an important part. The other part that I was going to mention is, and that's around responsibility. Both Mary and yourself, Derek, discussed the responsibility being a core item. And I want to add one layer to responsibility, which is it responsibility to our local community, to our country, or is it to the world? And the reason I say that is, not much mining compared to what we use is actually happening on our grounds. It's really imported from different locations, be it in developing countries, be it in China, and all of that supply chain and all of those happens there, including the iron and things like that. And then they're shipped to the US, where we end up being consumers, shipped to Europe and elsewhere. So the end consumers aren't necessarily the locations where all of that mineral and extraction is happening. So the question is, well, in that case, if it's not on our soil, should we further amplify that we have a responsibility also for the communities that are destroyed in Africa or in Central Asia or in Southeast Asia, even though it's not on our soil? I know Mary discusses lithium and the Thacker Pass, which is important. But I just wanted to highlight, as a percentage of the actual consumption, it's really, really small. And if we wanted to discuss responsibility, we'd want to have even a more holistic, which is where you're coming from, of can we discuss a holistic change in our behavior that that affects all of the extractive world and not necessarily just our backyard. So, yeah, a comment there that I wanted to add.
I think to add to Saad's comments, We all have to be responsible. It's not only at the local, regional, it's a global responsibility, in order for, us to survive this crisis. I appreciate the fact that, Derek did mention the land implications, where that's involved, at least in the Western United States. Land that's being mined is indigenous land. And, we not only are dealing with lithium mining in Nevada, we've been dealing with gold mining since, people crossed the ocean. And gold mining is, the majority of the mines in Nevada are located on Western Shoshone ancestral lands. That's Nua Sogovia. That's the people's earth mother. When this happens, you know, when mining extraction or any type of extraction industries comes, that only for Native people, for Indigenous people, that just, you know, perpetuates the idea that extraction industries to the land is more important than the rights of Indigenous people to their own land. So, you know, it's really a quandary regarding mining activity, and especially on Indigenous lands. You know, it's our original instruction for many Native Indigenous views is that we have the spiritual relationship with the earth. And with that being said, again, Derek mentioned the reciprocity, and that's another principle that the Shoshones live by. We just don't take. We talk to the plant. We talk to the animals, we talk to that rock or even that mountain, and we ask their permission to take. And we tell that living being what we're going to use them for. And we're going to be very appreciative and thankful and believe that that living element and offering. That's how the way the Shoshones live with that, with reciprocity in mind as a principle of living. And so for me, as I watch our planet struggling to keep life, to maintain and sustain life, there's not very much reciprocity going on that I know of that we can say where we are actually truly taking care and loving our relatives.
Thank you. Yeah. Saad, I had a question for you to, riff off the lithium just a little bit more. And then first of all, a totally kind of, you know, there's so many things that it's all interconnected, but another thing that popped into mind is we're talking about water and everything too is, how much water I recently heard is used in these like server farms to keep them cool where all this data is stored and stuff. It's just a whole other consideration that's often in really dry areas also. What would the analysis would be so much more complex if we were actually doing the cost analysis, right? So a question I had Saad on solar. I got your book right here, the Energy Storage Basics, a Study Guide for Energy Practitioners. And one of the pages here on 168, you say, as of 2019, and depending on how the battery is used, grid operators and utilities, so we're talking about the stationary batteries, like you mentioned, where there's not really as much of a size limit as you need in mobile applications, grid operators and utilities expect to replace lithium-ion batteries within 10 to 15 years of usage. So two questions. The first quick one, is that same kind of lifespan similar for like car batteries and stuff as well? And then the other question is, so what happens to them after? What's the current state of that and where's it headed? Could you address that, Saad?
Yeah, that's the big question. And because the EV revolution or EV industry is relatively new, we haven't had 10 to 15 years worth of battery in order to decide. Do we have a game plan to how to recycle all of this? What energy practitioners will tell you is the way that you use the battery will determine how long what the life cycle, what the lifetime of the batteries that you have is going to be. So you literally have different pricing and different economics and different technical solutions where it tells you, if you only use 50% of the capacity, or if you use X amount of the batteries of the energy that you purchase, then we can guarantee you an extra 5 years or an extra X amount of years. But otherwise, the degradation will be relatively steep. So the way that a lot of practitioners are thinking right now is how can we reutilize all of the a battery once it only has 20% of its efficiency left, and then can we then stock up all of those batteries from cars and from houses or from utilities and refurbish them in a way or reinstall them in places that require energy storage and primarily grid applications. I'd say this is a very much a way that EV is considering recycling of lithium ion batteries, is to kind of aggregate all of those car batteries that are not suitable to continue being used, but still have maybe 20% of their life or their energy remaining, and then installing them within a grid application. So that's directionally how things are looking, but we don't have a clear recycling industry. There is one big company that was started by the ex-CTO of Tesla, and that is focused on recycling of lithium ion batteries. So with that in mind, and it's based in Nevada. But yeah, it's a huge industry that needs to be localized. And I don't think we've solved or created a game plan that is very clear. And it's going to require regulatory and authorities to help speed that up, in my view.
Right. Yeah. And I think we'll get to that in a minute. But Derek or Mary, did any of you have anything else to add on what's hanging right now? Great. Okay.
I was going to add one thing, Tim, if I may. One of the other big implications that we see, and that's maybe the last 5 years the last 5 years, is there is a push towards localizing supply chains close to wherever the consumers are. So in the U.S., we have a situation where traditionally we're reliant on importing our manufacturing and our goods and our batteries, as well as our panels, from different countries. Now from China primarily and Asia. Now the push in the US, in Europe and other places is, well, we absolutely need to think strategically and not trust that we can always have access to these strategic resources. So therefore we need to double down on creating a supply chain that is inside of our country. So from a world that was, where we had the production located in one place, it's going to be a lot more distributed. And that's where what Mary is talking about is going to become more and more of an issue, because we are also from very high up creating a game plan that requires us to localize and produce and extract our own resources, or find our own resources and create jobs at the local level. And it's very pronounced in Europe. So Europe is even more pronounced than what we see in the U.S. in trying to really bring jobs and create them by building a supply chain and being independent from the world way or world commerce.
Great, yeah. And then I guess as we create these jobs, how do we not put all the plants and wildlife and all the climate managers out of a job in the process, right? So I guess that leads to another question that I'd love to explore with y'all. So about accountability, and you know, like Saad, you mentioned, we really have to take into consideration the longer term impacts. Derek, I've heard you say, you know, you probably make good decisions if you're thinking like you're going to be in a place for 500 years, you know, that multi-generational thinking, seven generations thinking is a phrase that's becoming more popular. But what does that look like for that sort of consideration to be applied on the ground? You know, what sort of limiting factors on innovation, you know, 'cause we know when there's a limiting factor, whether it's legislative or conflict, or it affects the directions that we point our creativity, you know. So the question really is like I mentioned, you know, Mary, you're on the board of the Great Basin Resource Watch and that and a few other organizations with the Thacker Pass situation. It's like, you know, there's, like I mentioned before, there's these grassroots, limiting factors for a mining company is often, you know, the legal costs of litigating with small grassroots environmental organizations, or, you know, lost work days for like, protests and things like that. And it seems like we all care about it more than that. And so there's more that we could do as a society, more that we could all even agree on. As far as what might that accountability look like maybe in the permitting phase, you know, where it's not as easy, you know, when there's a bunch of ecologists and local indigenous folks that don't want it, that is harder for those things to go through. So, you know, assuming that both are going to be around for a long time, you know, the renewables and this resistance, but is there a way that we can kind of systematize those limiting factors a little bit better in a way that makes sense? Mary, since I mentioned you and your work with the Great Basin Resource Watch, can you speak to that first as far as how you see we might be able to move in a direction that where the renewables industry in particular and mining in general is held accountable to ecology and people of place? Any thoughts to share on that? And then we'll just go through to Saad and Derek after. Mary?
Sure. Some of my thoughts, again, relates to perhaps consumption of resources that mining involves. Here in Nevada, we're the driest state in the nation, and mining is pumping thousands and thousands and thousands of gallons of water out 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Mining never stops here in Nevada at all. And so for Native people, we have to deal with the fact that projects come all the time. They start, and then they do mining. The mining industry here does piecemeal. They'll start a project, and then they end up expanding and making all these plans. But what's missing from these plans right from the get-go is talking to the indigenous people of the land. They're the last people who are ever consulted, ever. And they're the last ones to know about any project. So I guess for indigenous people, consultation isn't consent. And when we're brought in, when Indian Native people are brought in at the last of the planning, what chance do they have to say, you're going to destroy my land? Because they've already put holes in the ground. And they're saying, oh, here, well, we already started, so sorry, but let us help mitigate these problems. And usually mitigation involves money. I guess that's probably the only way to make people happy is through money. I don't get that, but that's how things are operable here with mining and Native people in Nevada. I think that limits us to be able to protect our land. We have a right to our lands. We have a right, just as everyone else, to have a say in how our lands are treated. I think that leaves us limitless or unlimited to be able to have a say of what's being done on our land.
Thank you, Mary. Yeah. Saad, what could you share about your thoughts on how we might be more accountable, how the industry might be more accountable to the ecology and also indigenous sovereignty and well-being of local communities in general, as Mary's talking about. And as you mentioned, these projects are often on indigenous lands. So what are some of your thoughts on how we might move in ways towards more accountability to those considerations?
Got it. I'd say, you discuss permitting. So at the permitting's level, when you are given authorizations, that's the prime timing to actually put in place safeguards around all of those considerations. One thing that, as you were talking and as Mary was sharing, came to my mind was, if there's a requirement at the level of designing and applying for that for permits to track and have a threshold of how much of the material that is used needs to be recyclable or reused for other repurposed for other use cases. And as long, if we set that standard high, then even at that installation and that design perspective, all the framework and all the processes are put in place to take into account decommissioning. What do we do with that? And right now we don't really have that. So if at the very onset, we already have a game plan to what do we do with all this material later down the road, then it pushes us from thinking immediate gains to actually having a plan for 25 years from now. So that's the kind of thought process that would be very helpful. I'd say thinking of any project nowadays has some requirement to think of what is the community, the impact on the community, and that's where the community needs to have a say. What I've seen that has been really cool as it relates to, let's say, a solar project, for example, and that if we can replicate this type of thinking more globally or more holistically to non-solar and other types of infrastructure and development projects, which is there are areas that are desertic that actually became less desertic and suitable for planting and for agriculture because we've taken advantage of the shading that solar panels create in order to then allow farmers and planters to grow crops under them. So using that as an area to actually grow crops and create sustainability. And that's a whole new area called agrivoltaics. So agriculture with like solar voltaics. And it's that kind of circularity that I think would be very beneficial if we have that on a legal and at the permitting stage to decide how can we integrate to be positive, to be net positive for the community where the project is being implemented, and also being around the recyclability and making sure that at least a high threshold and percentage of the material that has been used is going to be reclaimed and reused for repurposed for later down the line. Yeah, those are my thoughts, Tim.
Great. Any other thoughts on at the permitting phase, greater accountability? So you mentioned what happens with the materials later. Another considerations of like using spaces for crops and stuff is which have as of course its own considerations with the local hydrology and things like that. But in particular about the pre-existing ecology and local communities' interests, you might say the ethno-ecology. What might that look like at the permitting phase to have it be a little more stringent? And this is open for everybody. I mean, to get a little more specific, the question, what would that look like at the permitting phase to have it be not so easy to get it if you have ecologists and local indigenous and stuff, you know, what might that look like?
So my thought is, the way that it looks like today and a lot of it's limited today is we're thinking from job creation at the community level. That's the benefit that people think of projects like that is communities will say, well, I want at least X percentage of the people that are working on this project to actually be local so that we actually are creating opportunities for my community. Is that enough though? I don't think it's enough. And it really is the community that has a stake and has the ability to set the rules and decide what is it that they want out of it. I don't think the goal of let us not have any project makes sense. But I think that creating very strong asks that are support both the local community as well as support the development is where we have to do. So it is a reconciliation that is necessary and not like, hey, we don't want anything here because then it's detrimental for certain communities that maybe are in an area that cannot attract or bring jobs and creates economic opportunities for their locals. And, you know, I am talking very much from a technical and an economic perspective. So if I'm repetitive, it's kind of also an opportunity to share how a business or an investor or a technical project developer thinks of solutions like this.
Right. And how can these considerations be, you know, move back and forth between the worlds? Derek, you have
Yeah, I have a few things. I'm sorry, Mary, you can go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay. I think part of the problem is that when these mitigations go in, the losers every single time are the desert tortoises and the greater sage grouse. And they don't want jobs. They just want their homes. Mm-hmm. And part of the, there's a bunch of problems here. One of them is that every single hard rock mine in the history of mining, every single one has polluted groundwater. And that's, okay, that's one statement. Another statement is, I am 60 and basically, and I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, and I hate going back there because, and not because of mining in this case, but because in this case of urban sprawl. And I honestly don't know anyone who wants to go back to where they grew up because the place has been hammered. And this is happening everywhere and we all hate it and it continues. And a reason it continues is because the economic system is more important to us than local communities or life on the planet. And then one more story to tell here having to do with how the economic system sort of gets us everywhere is I was getting interviewed by this guy from Nature magazine several years ago, and he was a dedicated Marxist who believed that you could have an entire industrial global economic system that's based purely on voluntary exchanges. And he believed you can have cities and have this. And I said, great, how do you get around in your city? And he said, buses. I said, great, what are the buses made of? He said, metal. I said, great, where do you get the metal? He said, from mines. I said, great. How do you get people to work in the mines? He said, you pay them a lot. And I said, well, you know, mining is such a horrible existence that it was one of the first forms of slavery, but I'm going to give you that one. But what do you do? Because you just paid them a whole bunch to spend their lives underground. I said, but what do you do about the fact that every hard rock mine pollutes groundwater? What do you do about the people? You know, he obviously didn't care about the fish. So I said, what do you do about the people who live next to the river? He said, well, you pay them to move. I said, well, what if they've lived there for 5,000 years and their ancestors are buried there and they're not going to move? He said, well, you pay them more. I said, well, they're not going to move. And he said, how many of them are there? And I said, I don't know. What difference does that make? Let's say there's 500. He said, well, the million people in the city vote and they vote that the 500 people have to leave for the good of society. And I said, so what you're telling me is in less than a minute, you've gone from purely voluntary exchanges to democratic empire, land theft from indigenous people, and genocide. Also, you can have a bus. And the point is that I understand that we have painted ourselves into a corner, and we painted the entire planet into a corner because our way of life, which brings, as Mary said earlier, great elegancies and comforts and modern medicine and, you know, some good things to us, is based systematically and functionally on destroying the capacity of the planet to maintain life. And so I think, I mean, I fully understand that people need jobs, and I'm putting scare quotes on it because yes, they need jobs, but what we really need is breathable air, drinkable water, and land that will support us. And unfortunately, and I've lived my entire life in the West, and I am fully aware of the necessity for people to get jobs in the timber industry so that they can support themselves. But what they're doing as they do this is destroying the capacity of the land to take care of them in the future. And so I think, for me at least, yes, I understand within this system we have permitting processes and we have various mitigation things. And I want to say one more thing after this. We have various mitigation tactics, but that doesn't alter the fact that the system is functionally, systematically on the largest scale based on destroying life. And then one more thing I want to say, which is accountability. I wrote this satirical essay several years ago that, you know, I don't normally believe in technical solutions to these problems. I think the problems are really problems of value. But I do have a technical solution to the accountability problem with environmental destruction from these projects. And it's a very simple one. And what it is remote controlled cigar cutters. Because what you do is when somebody comes into a project and they say, we're going to put in this mine and it won't affect sage grouse at all. You say, okay, that's fine. And now we're going to attach remote controlled cigar cutters to your genitals. And if this actually does harm sage grouse, we'll just activate the remote controlled cigar cutter. The point is to bring accountability back to, you know, I have fought so many timber sales that they said there will be no significant impact. And then every time there's significant impact. Or you put in the deep water horizon well, great. It's not going to leak. There's going to be no problems. But the thing is, if there are problems, what's the worst thing that happens? That the Tony Hayward ends up getting a $36 million golden parachute as he gets fired? It's like, no, if you're going to go in and you're going to do a project that potentially harms others, you need to have skin in the game. And this is satirical. I mean, I'm not actually suggesting remote-controlled cigar cutters, but my point is that there are no consequences for those who make the predictions that end up every time being false. So accountability, that's really one of the part of the problem. There is no accountability. And the problems always come, the ones who pay every single time are, so the humans who live on the land and also the land itself. You know, it just kills me. I know this is kind of off topic, but it kills me that more than 100% of the water in the Colorado River is allocated and they're continuing to issue permits for more water. It's like, and then they get surprised when Hoover Dam is at the lowest it's ever been. Really? Really? You're surprised at that when you're taking out more than 100% of the water? It's just nuts. The whole thing is nuts. So I just needed to get that off my chest.
Thank you, Derek. I appreciate your words and what they mean. I don't know, Saad said that the permitting process is where the locals can make grievances. I don't know, that's kind of difficult in Nevada when Nevada state agencies help companies actually do very well. They don't want to turn down permits here. They want mines to happen. I just think that at the early stages of mine development, that it would be good business for these multi-international companies to develop relationships with the indigenous people of the land, not when they need them, before they need them, because indigenous people are used entirely for their land and resources. And so others just go through the motions of making it legitimate. So I guess I would like to see these companies develop important relationships and to understand that connection for indigenous people to the land. The land is identity. I mean, it's multifaceted. It's holistic. It's a sustainer. And number one, it's our ancestral connection to place. Our ancestors are here. They're buried here. They're in the mountains. They're in the rocks. They're in the soil. Those are our ancestors that are disrespectfully removed. When there's mining projects that happen, Native people don't have rights to our ancestors. I guess for me, to understand how we have this relationship to the land and to help others to understand the meaning of it, you know, the land is our healer along with water. We use the water every day ceremoniously. Water is so important to indigenous people. It's every day a ritual to pray with the water, for the water, for the land. The land is a source of knowledge. The land can tell you something. It has all the answers there. You don't have to destroy it. You just have to commune and have a relationship with it. Land is home for Native people. This is our home. Thank you, Derek, for talking about how this comes about and for Indigenous people who we don't have anywhere to go. We can't get up and move. We're here. We're here. We respect it. We respect our ancestors, what they had to have gone through for us to be here today. You have to understand this country wanted to wipe us out. We're here. We're still here. Land is spirit, and it's our responsibility to keep this land as sacred as it should be. I just think there's more relationship developing that's involved. And I think there has to be more understanding of Indigenous knowledge, thought, relationships. And I just think those things are, in my mind, what is needed.
Yeah. Saad, do you have anything that you'd like to share about in response to considerations that Mary's sharing and these relationships, and also what you think might be a humane equivalent of the remote control cigar cutter as far as accountability after the fact as well? What can you share with us?
Developing relationships with local communities and jurisdiction or, authority having jurisdiction is something we talk a lot about within the energy space or just the regulatory and permitting space. That's a difficult question, and I don't have an answer. I wish I could think of how can we incentivize local community or project developers or authorities to actually make sure that the local communities and no one is discriminated against or no one is hurt out of this. And unfortunately, it still is very much seen as a solution to create jobs and development or economic development is the prism at which all those decisions are taken from. The best example for what Derek was mentioning and the biggest fear for a lot of companies is what happens to their stocks, to the price of their stock market or the company stock. And that I would say is the equivalent of what would cause cigar chopper to chop leadership within organizations and cause those organizations to really rethink of the implications of what they have there. What we see in the investment as well as the development and projects spaces, there's an ask from consumers to make sure that what they're ending, where they're spending their money and where, whether the products that they end up consuming are coming from, very clean and very sustainable practices. So that is where the education needs to happen, in my view, is, making sure that consumers are cognizant about what is the impact of their consumption, on the local community. And once that circular relationship happens so that an end consumer knows that by purchasing and by doing activity A, they're actually hurting tribe B that is further away. And this is the implication of those impacts. That's what would really change the incentives and make people question whether the project the impacts of their activities and their lifestyle. So that's what I would say, is how I would consider a solution if we could tie and educate consumers as to the impact that they have from their actions, at the local level where projects are communities. And, what Mary is talking about is really people not being aware of what the impact of their actions are. And, Mary talks about it in a very passionate and a very clear way. And if more people heard and knew that, then people would question and would perhaps change their behaviors, is my thought.
Would that mean like not using products that need lithium and copper and cobalt instead? What would that look like? Yeah.
I will say I will say that when it comes to mining, one of the big an example of that is most battery manufacturers nowadays have actually made a pledge or are working towards moving away from cobalt. And the reason why, even if cobalt makes a lot of economic sense and technically is a good solution to have as part of the lithium ion battery chemistry, the fact that it is primarily extracted from Congo and from certain areas that have very questionable human rights activities and have massive impact on the local community has actually seen companies say, no, we're going to move away from relying on that and actually moving to something that may be more expensive, but at least we won't be tagged and be associated with causing child labor and causing destruction of communities and things like that. Unfortunately, there's always going to be an economic cost to anything along those lines. But when people are aware, and the example that I gave of the cobalt shows that maybe there are alternative chemistries or alternative ways of producing batteries that don't necessarily require as much extractive metals and minerals. I don't know what that looks like. That would be more of like a scientist or like a electrochemist to actually talk about that more closely. But creating that mechanism and that incentives is what would help in my view.
Right. Any cigar cutter thoughts as far as beyond incentives, like after the fact, like Derek was saying, a lot of times they say, basically, yeah, accountability to actually not doing what you say you won't do and doing what you say you'll do. As far as
I'll tell you, the biggest fear for projects along those lines is they require so much like upfront capital and investment that the biggest fear they have is actually them not going through after the investment has been made. So imagine if you have a solar power plant where after you've built it and everything, and then you're not allowed to sell it or sell the electricity from it. That's the biggest nightmare that anybody can think about. And if you have that, that gun like on your head and thinking about that, you will absolutely make sure to never have a scenario where that happens. Similarly for mines, you know, if you put in place all the infrastructure to start mining and then all of a sudden your permit was retired or like removed or we were relieved of the permit or the local, you don't have the right to proceed. Oh my God, that is like such a big nightmare. I'm still thinking from an economic perspective. So it's not a human behavior, like a legal thing. But if what I see businesses respond to is those economic penalties or those economic incentives, and as a behavioral, someone that has studied behavioral economics and spent a lot of time with people that are in that field, it works pretty well, is what I can say.
Be the economic remote control cigar cutter right there. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Any other responses to anything that's been said? Derek, you good for the moment?
No, I'm good, and I mean I'm really enjoying this, and I hate to say it, but I'm gonna have to go in a little while.
I was about to actually wrap it up because we could talk about this stuff forever. I was just gonna give everyone a chance to maybe say one last thing if you'd like. Derek, since we're talking to you at the moment, would you like to go ahead and share any last thoughts to close this? And I want to just thank you all for sharing. You know, we don't have to come to all the answers in agreement on everything, but it's been really nice hearing the different perspectives play off each other, and hope for a lot more of that sort of thing. Derek, any final words from you?
Yeah, I want to thank you for setting this up, because I think that these are in fact some of the most important conversations that need to be held in public, and no matter on what levels we agree or disagree, I think we could probably all agree that we are either appalled or saddened or both by the fact that these conversations about some of the most important issues of our time are not taking place in public much more often. And so I really appreciate you having set this up, and Saad and Mary for participating and saying everything you've said.
Great. Saad, any last thoughts to share for this conversation?
Yeah. Similar to what Derek mentioned, I really appreciate the different perspectives and the angles that everybody brings with their expertise and their experience. I really appreciate what Tim, you were discussing, especially as it relates to the second leg of climate change. And I know we didn't discuss that as much, but I want to just redirect people towards listening and understanding that, because that's the type of alarming and the call of action that we should be discussing, as opposed to the immediate decarbonization, is really understanding the long-term impacts of our current actions to solve an immediate problem more immediate problem, when there are other considerations that are going to be much more dire going forward. And precipitation is one of those that's water and hydrology is a huge part as part of renewable energy. And and a world that doesn't have enough hydrology is not going to be would not be conducive to allow our transition to clean energy. So yeah, that's a thought that I have. And if I can be of any support or any resource for others, and Tim, I just want to really acknowledge you for creating this space for us to share our perspectives and making this interactive in the way that it is. So thank you.
Thank you. Yes. For a deep dive into the science that Saad is referring to, how our disturbing activities on Earth directly disrupt weather and climate patterns, including precipitation, you can listen to the first episode in this Water, Life, Climate, and Civilization series, Professor Mian, The Second Leg of Climate Change.
My last words on this program today I want to first thank you and thank Derek and Saad as the panelists as well. But my last words and thought is treat the earth as if she is your mother. Respect, revere, and love her. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, everyone. You have a beautiful day.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening and sharing if you're inspired to. Financial support of the Musicology Podcast is also very much appreciated, either at patreon.com/musicology or with the PayPal donate button at museecology.com. And again, thanks for listening.
Waves stand as the river flows until the earth underneath it changes form, and patterns persist in societal norms till our shared stories shift and we all change form. Our shared stories shift and we all change form. And more intelligence floats on the waters and breeze than we analyze in machines and committees. And when this understanding begets what we do, then our machines and committees will serve that too. Our machines and committees will serve that too. Thank you. my mind is overgrown, and my heart feels that we are changing to the bone. And nobody's plan can command how it goes. Where the barons and peasants all share one home. The barons and peasants all share one home. And there's an old melody brooding anew. And out of our noise we are catching its groove. Song is unwritten, depends what we do. And it'll be what we fed that determined what grew. And it'll be what we fed that determined what grew.